And good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I am your regular Wednesday host every Wednesday of the month. And this is the second Wednesday, so I do have my regular guest or guest host, as it were, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie. Oh, are you with us, Jackie? Anyway, that was... I've been wanting to play some Sinead O'Connor for quite some time, since she passed on in an untimely way just a couple months ago. What a wonderful voice and spirit. What a powerful spirit Sinead was, and we miss her greatly. And that was, of course, Peter Tosh's reworking, which he called Down Presser Man of the Traditional African-American Spiritual Sinner Man. So here we are, and, hello, Jackie. Okay. Well, we'll wait for, okay. I guess she got off the line somehow. And, my trusty board operator, Ty, is going to call her back. So we will shortly have her. So yes, when you're under the sea, yeah, it's a kind of a turn. It's sort of it's a Judgment Day song originally, Sinner Man. What are you going to do when you're facing the Judgment Day? And Peter Tosh sort of reworked it into a song about, what's going to happen to the oppressors when the Judgment Day comes. Of course, what's going to happen to us all when the next climate catastrophe befalls us wherever we are. Of course, what happened in Libya was just a stark warning about the dangers of fragile infrastructure in the face of increasing large-scale climate events. So it looks like we might have Jacqueline Keeler with us. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
So good to have you back on, as usual, on our second Wednesday. So we, I don't know where this is going to go. This is an unfamiliar position for me. I decided I'll just announce it to the world, since I so rashly put it as a headline on my program page. This is my birthday, yes.
And, happy birthday.
Thank you. I am officially of Medicare age. I just put it all out there now. Anyway, so... I said, let's just do something different. And so we decided that I would put myself, as I said, in the unfamiliar position of being interrogated by you, questioned by you. And so I don't know. I hope you've got all softball questions for me, because I have no idea where this is going to go. And actually, it makes me a little nervous. But it shouldn't, because we're friends. So you've got nothing you're going to... spring on me, I hope. But anyway, all that preliminary. So yeah, we just thought it would be interesting, since I don't know, just to turn the tables. So you take it away, Jackie.
Yeah, I thought that first of all, I'd like to say happy birthday to Paul, and I really would like to take this time to let the audience know more about Paul's own history, and particularly with Indigenous issues in Oregon and also, the United States. And I, as a Native journalist, one of the things I often get asked by non-Native folks who are interested in the issues, like, what can they do? What's their role in all of this? And so I really think that, I think that Paul is a great example of what you can do, and what caring people can do to protect not only the environment, but social justice issues, the right to life, all these things, which are not only Indigenous issues, but they're human issues. And they're reflective of our own humanity, how we treat each other, how we respect our mother and all of her children. And so, I'd love to take this time to to let the audience know more. I think, would you like to start with probably your first interactions with the Native community?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, I guess, you know, it would probably be, I don't know how interesting it would be. It seems like there's something sort of through my family a little bit. I want to honor my father who actually did write a book called Great Indian Chiefs. It was, you know, for a juvenile audience. It was kind of kind of superficial, but he actually grew up. It's kind of interesting. He grew up in Italy, and there's a sort of romantic fascination. We've talked about this a little bit with Native Americans, you know, it went in some really kind of very stereotyping ways and some kind of actually ugly ways. But there is just this longing for, you know, for freedom, you know, for whatever that romantic image represented, you know, the noble savage, you know, the free life before civilization, whatever, you know. And there's something good in that, but there's also something that sort of escapist anyway. So there's, as in Germany, there's a very, very, very popular children's book writer that influenced entire generations of, in fact, led to, I think, to like these sort of people do sort of copying native ways as they saw it in these encampments and stuff. Anyway, so in Italy too, there was
I think it's called the Indianer thing.
Yep. Ich bin ein Indianer, to paraphrase John F. Kennedy. Anyway, so there was an Italian writer, and so my dad apparently dressed as an Indian, whatever that was. I regret not talking to my dad about so many things, but, you know, whatever, you know, it's like this thing. So I think that remained with him, and I don't know if that really influenced me, but I actually ran into, there's these, this Whole Life Expo thing. I don't know if you remember that. It was this, sort of this, the New Age movement that kind of grew out of the, you know, the counterculture of the 1960s. It became this big deal all around the country. These event, they had these big expos with all these authors, and people had these tables. Anyway, Sun Bear was actually at one, and so I ran into him, and yeah, just these little things. And then I found out about the Piscataway Indians, who are the indigenous inhabitants of where I came from on the East Coast, the Washington, D.C. area. And I started to read a little bit about them, you know, found out that there is a this some sort of flint making quarry somewhere in Rock Creek Park, which is a very special place in the heart of D.C. And tried to find it anyway, you know, just these sort of little echoes that sort of foreshadowed maybe my involvement. But yeah, so I got to Oregon I got to the West Coast in 1985, and immediately found myself at this event to protect the Sinkion Wilderness in Northern California, which became the first intertribal sort of joint managed indigenous, including indigenous people managed forested area. I don't really know the whole history of it, but so I met some people who were involved in Big Mountain, the struggle to protect your people's land, which you can talk about if you want, the supposed so-called joint use area, Navajo Hopi, that they're evicting a relatively few Hopi families and a large number of Diné or Navajo families from. And there's a kind of one of the last big sort of American Indian movement influenced movements, I believe, that was going on for a number of years. And 1986 was going to be the deadline. So there's a big, there's had all these kind of on the model of the survival gatherings in the Black Hills area that were, again, another sort of carryover of the 1960s, early 70s Native ferment. Anyway, so they had, I found out about that, and I wanted to get a ride. So I got a ride from this guy named Colin Kingfisher, who became a prominent part of my life for a few years. He was one of those figures that running around in Indian country and beyond, sort of like bridging sort of two or three or four different worlds as a Sundancer and Peyote Man and Aimster activist. His actually, his father had been, I believe, either his father or his grandfather had been actually killed on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation over coal issues, like way before anything. Anyway, there's, you know, Indian country is...
So Aimster, we should tell the audience, you're referring to someone who was a member of the American Indian Movement.
Yes, sorry.
And with his tribe, with his nation, Northern Cheyenne?
Yeah. So full blood. And so I ended up hanging out with all these... a bunch of Cheyenne people and a bunch of others. He kind of brought me into, I went down to Big Mountain with him, and it was just like this eye-opening experience for a suburban kid from Maryland, the D.C. suburbs. And it's just amazing, you know, teepees and, you know, just all these long-haired Native people, which, I mean, you know, subsequently, I just had never really met Native people, you know, prior to that encounter in Santa Cruz, where I went out west to be with my younger brother, who was at the UC, University of California, Santa Cruz. And that was my opening up. Although actually I have to go back a little further before that, actually. No, actually that was my first. And so I got to experience this whole thing. I went to my first sweat lodge afterwards. And actually was, I stayed afterwards, which was really great, because, you know, these heavy duty events last, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, and then everybody goes off to their, you know, their lives, or, you know, back to their reservations or their communities, whatever. And there was a lot of white supporters there, a lot of young people just getting into things, a lot of older people, a lot of movement lawyers. Anyways, just an amazing thing. There's hundreds and hundreds of people, all these remarkable people. And so I went to this, I stayed over, I went to my first sweat lodge, which I ignominiously had to escape from because I felt claustrophobia. So I jumped out of there. Anyway, they kept telling me, no, stay in, don't break the circle, you know, be strong. Anyway, I felt bad about that for a long time. But so I stayed afterwards and became part of this distribution crew, because there's these caravans that have been going down there for years and years. A lot of, mostly from the Northwest, was a big, big support center for the, you know, there's always been this sort of connection between the Southwest and the Northwest, all sorts of different ways. One of them was this big support network for Big Mountain. All these support groups up and down Seattle, Olympia, Portland, et cetera. And Portland had a big support group. And so I got on the crew of, there had been these caravans to bring all these supplies to the families. And you know, these people, many of the elders have passed on since, but there's all these mostly strong women elders, and I got to meet some of them. I got to go around to the different hogans, all these far-flung communities, and actually distribute, you know, blankets and food, and which is just a mind-boggling. It was really an eye-opening experience, because, as you know, it's your reservation, your mother's reservation. It's the most, I don't know, it's like you keep saying it's the size of Ireland, but it really feels like another country if you're out there. It really does. It's like, it's just a whole other world. It was just amazing. So anyway.
Wait, just to stop there. So you became part of the Big Mountain Black Mesa support group effort to support Navajos trying to remain on the land in face of federal removal. And at the time, there was a deadline for 1986. And of course, just to give our audience a bit of background, the Navajo-Hopi land dispute was a dispute over which nation, the Hopi Nation or the Navajo Nation, whose land it was. And so there was supposed to be temporary sort of injunction to freeze the land from development, which mostly impacted Navajos who live on the land. Hopis tend to live in their villages, so they're not outspread across the land the way Navajos are. Navajos are pastoral; they graze sheep and goats and cattle, so they're on the land. And so these elderly Navajo women were taking care of animals, and this is the only way of life they knew. Also, I should note that time period, most of the elders did not speak English. So, you know, being relocated, and the real goal of the Navajo Hopi land dispute was not really out of Congress's concern or, you know, Senator Goldwater's concern for Navajo or Hopi people. The real issue was energy, was mining coal. The Black Mesa area was strip mined for coal, and then the groundwater, billions of gallons of groundwater in the desert was used to slurry coal. Drinking water was used slurry coal because they were too cheap to build a train track. And then there were two very large coal-fired power plants in the area, and one at the Four Corners area and the other one near Lake Powell. And these created a methane cloud the size that you can see from space, basically over the Four Corners area. So Navajo people, most of whom live without electricity, or at least 30% of whom live without electricity or running water, more back then, a larger percentage, weren't actually getting any of this energy, and it was all going to build and grow the cities of Phoenix and Las Vegas. So just to give a little and maybe describe what you saw when you got there that was sort of really surprising to you.
Well, just how far apart these little communities were. I mean, some of them weren't even communities. Some of them were just single dwellings, hogans, and some of them were, you know, multifamily communities. And anyway, it was just the road infrastructure. You know, I just remember going over these rock washes, you know, in these, you know, you had to have a pretty sturdy pickup. Yeah, just how quote primitive, you know, it was, but just how beautiful. I mean, because I was always kind of open to, you know, the ways of life that aren't totally inundated by hyper technology and stuff. And I don't know, and just the dignity, how they dressed, and the dignity, and I guess you'd say, to me, alienness, because they were just, you know, like, as you said, most of them didn't speak English, the elders. Yeah, just the kind of quiet dignity and how much survivors they were, and how just integrated into the landscape, how their ways of life. A lot of people would go down and help them, you know, relieve them from their sheep herding duties for like a day or, you know, a week or something, so they could do other, so they could be involved in the struggle. That was a big part of it. People were not just bringing stuff. I ended up not doing that a particular thing. It was very, very, very eye-opening. So then I was on my way up to Olympia to see someone I met at that thing, and I came to Portland for the first time. I ended up coming up to Oregon to be on this farm on the coast with that guy Kingfisher and a bunch of other people, a bunch of activists and people involved in ceremonies and stuff, and got involved in a lot of that. But anyway, so I came up to Portland in May, and I met I ended up doing the same thing I did in Santa Cruz. I saw a flyer for an event, which happened to be a salmon feast, and for the salmon scam defendants on a telephone pole. So like I did in Santa Cruz, I called up the number to get, you know, to go and offer my services, kind of meet people, basically. And so I ended up at this woman who's no longer with us, a longtime heavy-duty activist in Portland. And I was there, and they said, oh, yeah, just to hang out. And Susana Santos and her mother, Lena, showed up with their truck with a I'm off mic. I'm trying to put myself back and sort of have my eyes closed. Anyway, so they dropped off a load of salmon to clean. So I was put to work cleaning salmon for the salmon benefit for these salmon scam defendants, the So Happies and Wilbur Slockish, who is still living, and one of the traditional chiefs of the Columbia River people, and some others who got to, I think there is a five who ended up in prison out of that crazy, crazy case, which we can talk about because it's really important. In fact, I guess it's almost like the 40th anniversary, I think, of the start of those trials. So,
what do you want to elaborate a little bit more about the folks involved in that case?
I guess politically the important thing to know is, well, these are people, the Columbia River community is just amazing, and I should have some of them back on this program eventually again, like I did for years back in the 80s and 90s when I did my first KBOO work. And they were the ones who kind of, a lot of them refused to move off and to the reservations because they basically created the reservations out of the 1855 treaties with the Yakima, Warm Springs, Umatilla, et cetera. What they're called now the treaty tribes, the five treaty tribes. They created these reservations well away from the Columbia River, which is kind of their main center of gravity, although all the tributaries were very important, which we can talk about. But you know, the big fishery was not just at Celilo's, that was the biggest, but there's ones all the way up and down, especially where there are rapids where they could set up their platforms to fish. These were kind of the hardcore resistors, I guess, in some ways. I'm oversimplifying it because there's, you know, Native people have been resistors as a whole generally, but they were in some ways because they were some of the ones who maintained this particular local religion called the Seven Drum or Feather religion, and there is long houses that practice that religion all up and down the river. And David Sohappy was both kind of a spiritual and political leader of the community. And his a relative of his was one of the ones who did one of the first fish-ins on the Columbia River in the 60s that led to the Bolt decision guaranteed a right to harvest their fish in common with the citizens, the European citizens of the, as according to the treaties, the Bolt decision guaranteed in Washington state, and the Bologna decision came out of that originally, that case with Richard Sohappy out of the 60s, which ended up creating the Intertribal Fish Commission and guaranteeing, and really in some ways helping to transform from being a totally renegade to actually having some guaranteed rights, and then they had to keep fighting for all those rights. Anyway, so they did have these rights, but they continued, then they passed this Black Bass Lacey Act, because it continued to target them nevertheless, the state, mostly state wildlife officials. It was just like this constant low level and sometimes almost open warfare on the Columbia River through those years. And also, you know, racist white citizens trying to deny them their rights. Anyway, so they passed this Black Bass Lacey Act, which made it a federal crime to transport illegally caught salmon across state borders, which conveniently for Slade Gorton was the one who got this passed, the senator, the very rabidly anti-Native senator from Washington state. And yeah, it basically allowed them to add a whole other layer of persecution, which they then used to target. They set up these undercover fish buying operations. Can you imagine? At Celilo and other places on the river, and paid really good prices for these prized prime. What they got the best prices, because these are people who, this was their river, and that's how they made their living, and so they didn't really see things the same way as all these layers of illegal legality they imposed upon them. So yeah, they fished and they took their chances, and so they paid really premium prices for these spring salmon, which was outlawed because of, you know, there's a valid reason, because they were trying to conserve the resource, but they just they used a very heavy-handed approach, a very uneven approach, because there's non-Indians who are allowed to catch, sports fishermen allowed to catch some. But anyway, so yeah, they set up these fish buying operations at Slough and other places, and entrapped, basically entrapped these native fishing people to sell them their salmon, and then charge them with this Black Bass Lacey Act, which had a federal up to 5 years in prison for catching fish from their river, which is just, so yeah, a whole support network movement started around that, which is very small because there really wasn't a lot of attention paid in the kind of progressive leftist community to native issues, frankly. I mean, I was, just because I came in and just fresh from out of town and, you know, just sort of fell, because I fell into the whole thing, the Big Mountain struggle, and got my eyes opened, I sort of was already primed, you know. It was just sort of a series of circumstances so I threw myself into this and ended up writing a bunch of articles for the Alliance that got some play and kind of pushed the issue in the media, I think helped push it onto the page. I think our coverage for the Alliance, rest in peace, the great Portland Alliance. I think it pushed it into the mainstream. And anyway, this whole chain of events that ended up becoming an international, went into the UN, and we succeeded in getting their sentences reduced, but the damage had already been done for poor David Sohappy, the great, great, strong, you know, spiritual, political leader of his community, who ended up, you know, because he was so far, that, you know, they always put people hundreds or thousands of miles away from home and move them around from prison to prison, don't give them their traditional foods. So they're, you know, if they already have health problems, they're exacerbated. So yeah, I see he suffered a couple strokes in prison and died. Thankfully, he did get out of prison before he died, which was good, got to be amongst his family. But yeah. That's a very abbreviated version of both my involvement and that whole issue, which is, you know, it's how it's gone since is really interesting. We can talk about. But anyway, go ahead.
I'm going to read a little bit about his trial, actually, from the Oregon Encyclopedia. They have an entry on David Sohappy, who was born in 1925 and died in 1991. Actually, it's written by my friend Andrew Fisher. I think this is the same Andrew Fisher who's done a lot of research on the Yakima Nation. And it says that here that, let's see, where did I just see that? I'm just, sorry about that. Okay, so Happy versus Smith is a famous decision that was reached in the Federal District Court, and that's the Bologna case that you mentioned. That's up the Fair Use Doctrine. And fair and equitable share. But during the next two decades, Sohappy and other dissidents continued to ignore both state and tribal fishing ordinances, this is from the Oregon Encyclopedia, that clashed with their spiritual beliefs. Consequently, in 1981, a federal state sting operation dubbed Salmon Scam netted him and his son David for selling fish caught with ceremonial use permits. Claiming that Indians had poached 40,000 salmon, federal agents prosecuted the Sohappys and 17 others under the Lacey Act, which had recently been amended to make illegal fishing a felony. Wow, a felony. Although biologists soon found the, quote, missing fish in tributary streams, where they had been driven by pollution, the Sohappys each received the maximum sentence of 5 years for selling 345 salmon. And then they tried to evict the residents of Cook's Landing, where they were fishing, because they said the sites were not meant to be a permanent residence, as you mentioned.
Right. That's a whole other, the 40,000 fish. Yeah, they didn't do the research because they could have found that they had not gone over the dam, because they count the fish as they go over Bonneville Dam. They could have actually done a little bit of due diligence and research and found that, yes, those actually had been diverted, because I think the aluminum smelter there had interfered with their homing mechanisms, which are incredibly powerful, and they had gone up a different tributary than they would have gone up. So, yeah. Anyway, so, yes, then things came together once. They did try to evict all those I mean, I don't know. There's a whole history to be written. I don't know if it really has been of those communities there at the. There's Underwood, where Johnny Jackson, the traditional Klickitat chief, who died just a few years ago, lived. There's Cook's Landing, which is another. These are the in lieu sites. They're called in lieu sites because they're in lieu of these traditional fishing sites where people would either, you know, after the dam was done, where they put in their boats. But before that, they'd be, you know, they'd have dip nets. There might be places where they'd have a place to put a platform and a dip net, or there'd just be access points, or there'd be a village or a house or whatever. There is, I think, 38 identified in lieu sites, I believe. They're called in lieu of these sites. The Army Corps of Engineers, when they built Bonneville in 1938 and flooded all these sites, like I say, some village sites, some, you know, house sites, some fishing sites, some access point sites, they flooded them, and they identified 38 of them that they're supposed to replace. And so they did, they only, I think there is like seven at that time, I believe. They've added some, partly out of this whole struggle that developed out of the original fish-ins of the 60s and then the whole movement around the salmon scam. Anyway, that's why they're called in lieu sites. They're in lieu of these original places. And so, so people, just like they, you know, continued to live, along the river, you know, and it'd be really interesting to know exactly where they had lived. I know there's Wishram up there across from the Dalles, where there's a relatively small native community where Wilbur Slocus had lived. Others, you know, that's the thing about, I always, in getting to know Indian country to the extent that I have, the very limited extent, it always kind of boggles my mind how there's these little pockets of communities off reservation is what really strikes me, that people have succeeded in, you know, in eking out their continuing to live as native people in under the most difficult of circumstances. Go ahead.
That's what makes the whole, you know, casual use, you know, even by folks like Hillary Clinton, of the term, you know, off the reservation, it, without the context of the oppression that it represented, really offensive. And I just wanted to read one last little bit from the Oregon Encyclopedia entry on David So Happy Sr. It says that they talk about how they went after the Bureau of Indian Affairs, tried to evict the residents of Cook's Landing, at the Amu fishing sites. The Warm Springs and Yakima tribal councils also urged the occupants to leave, but they insisted that the treaties and the religion gave them the right to stay. In 1986, 10 residents and a council of traditional chiefs sued to stop the evictions. Although the U.S. Court of Appeals ultimately upheld their position, David So Happy Sr. did not live to see it. His health deteriorated even after he received parole in 1988, and he died on May 6, 1991, just 5 months before the case closed. He remains a hero to many tribal activists and environmentalists. Mm-hmm. And so he was only in his 60s at that point, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah. That prison basically killed him. I mean, it really did.
Yes, he was 66 in 1991. Wow. Yeah. So he died.
Slade Gorton killed him. Let's just, sorry.
Yeah. Slade Gorton, so evil. Yeah. I'm glad that I know that the tribes in Washington State, they unified to basically, you know, fund his opposition candidate to basically get him out of office. They actually supported Maria Cantwell, the present senator, and stuff, because he was, Slade Gorton was pursuing so many anti-tribal sovereignty initiatives.
Well, we can talk a little bit. I just want to kind of close the loop on that in lieu site case is just the. I noticed it was somebody been waiting. I don't know how long. I hope Jay is still with us and hasn't been waiting too long. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Jay. I was just so wrapped up in this conversation because this brings, you know, I was so heavily involved in this for a number of years there. And then I kind of left, unfortunately. That's another story. But please call back, Jay. We will. We have two lines open, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I guess I had no way of, I didn't know where this is going, and I didn't actually know it would go here. And this is very intense stuff. Just to really quickly, so yeah, I think one of the lessons is, you're asking, what can you do? Well, first of all, you know, learn about the issues and struggles where you are, because wherever you are, there are, especially in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, you know, it was difficult for me in a lot of ways. I mean, like I say, I had the benefit of kind of innocence and youth, and I just sort of was able to, I guess I was the kind of person who could find my way into situations and not totally alienate people. Maybe it took a while for me to alienate people, but anyway, people could see I had, you know, something to offer or something, and I did, you know. Find out, you know, then, you know, offer your help, you know, because your help, you know, it can be useful and can be accepted if you offer it in a good way, and really follow up, you know, follow up and keep doing, stick with it no matter what happens. Because, you know, I had, you know, there's always, you know, there's rightfully a lot of Native people harbor a lot of resentments towards us colonizers, and you just have to, you know, you just have to roll with it, basically. And, you know, but if you approach it in a good spirit and in a good humor and, you know, good heart, you know, you can get to be accepted and do some good. So, and I think I did some good there. I regret having left and followed this this wild, crazy idea to go back to my indigenous roots in Italy, which I will just say for the public record, I think I feel in the end was a mistake, because really my calling, I feel now looking back, was really here, and I lost a lot of momentum. And I think, you know, I think people, you know, there's just not that many of us who are doing this kind of work, still not that many of us. So we're all kind of in some ways a precious resource if we're doing good work. Anyway, so the Inlusites, yeah, I mean, I don't think that, I guess the lesson there too is help be part of a movement. Help, you know, if there's a movement happening, like, you know, like you, we all saw with the No Dapple movement, which was just an amazing, you know, like that was my, you know, No Dapple movement came a long time before, with to see this move, you know, this totally marginalized community, which really didn't have hardly any support. You know, there's basically this Columbia River Defense Project. Brad Bovinger, I call you out. If you are out there, you did great, great work. And the community and I and everybody thanks you for that. That was one of the support groups that had, you know, it was a nonprofit that had funding to be able to fund. And then it was ended up, you know, Brad stepped aside and left it to, I believe Wilbur took over that after he left and became, you know, he turned over to Native leadership, which is also the way things should work. But they were the ones who stood behind, hired lawyers, and, you know, and then they helped support the evictions case. And the evictions case only won, I think, because there's this movement that had developed, which wasn't like it wasn't a No Dapple. It wasn't like thousands of people, but it doesn't necessarily take that much. You know, it takes just spreading the word. You know, just even, you never know, I guess, is the thing. You never know. Just like my involvement with the forest protection movement, we were just, you know, start out with a few dozen people. We had no idea it would snowball into this really big movement that really changed forest policy. Anyway, so yeah, I guess those are lessons. Find out, put yourself out there, get involved, and keep going.
I love what you're saying. I think that's fantastic. I think that, it's been fantastic perspective, and I really do wish and hope that you write more about it again. And it's an important history. I mean, and it needs more voices to remember what the work that's happened before, to teach the next generation what's possible. And I think what I found really interesting was, your description of going back to your own indigenous roots in Italy versus here, why do you feel like your work was more here than there? Is it because, to a certain extent, I don't know, because you're an American, because you're tied to this?
I mean, that's a big part of it, but just the kind of the depth of the relationships and the ties I had developed, I just didn't appreciate enough. I just didn't realize how precious. I mean, you make me cry here, but it was like, I mean, there is a whole other story. There's valid reasons why, you know, and there's so many layers to it, but ultimately just the relationships that I developed, I felt like I didn't really quite honor, and the momentum that had been developed, both with the forest protection and that native, you know, I just didn't realize. I guess I didn't realize also, kind of in some ways, that not to toot my horn, but how important the work, not how important I was, but how important the work that I and we were doing was, and how it needed to continue, and that was, and you can't. You know, you can't get back momentum. You can't get back. That's another important lesson. You know, once you got the momentum, stick with it.
Yeah. And the that's amazing. I think the only thing I wanted you to talk a little more about is definitely one of the things I find why I wanted to do this interview with you was. I do feel like more of this history needs to be remembered. You mentioned the Portland Alliance. You know, I don't see where you can even find the old issues, you know.
At the Oregon Historical Society. And, we have, the work has to be done. To if anybody wants to help, I don't know if they've digitized them. I keep meaning to call the Historical Society to find out if they've digitized them. If they haven't, that's a whole work that needs to be done to digitize this. At least the articles I written. I'm been very remiss in not having. I've been back now from Italy for 11 years, and I still haven't done that. But anyway, I could browbeat myself for an entire hour if you want.
Yeah, I think that's really important to remember our history. I think the history of organizing, particularly here in Portland and across the West Coast, I think, and the history of the fish and the fighting there. I mean, I know that there's we have now CRTFIC, the Columbia River, Tribal Fish Commission, which I believe grew out of that whole moment, that movement to fight for their rights
It did, and they were at odds, just like the official tribal councils of Yakima and Warm Springs and Umatilla were at odds with these. What were considered renegade, they just felt like they couldn't afford to support them because of what they had to lose in federal funding, et cetera. And this movement helped turn that around. In fact, you know, they were, CRTFIC was in a lot of ways against these, you know, because they were operating this whole big institutional federal level and stuff and trying to, you know, operate this very difficult space between the states, the federal government, the tribes. And so, yeah, they were basically sacrificed, these small communities on the river and the grassroots fishing people who, you know, just did it their way, the way they always, their families and ancestors already done it. And so this whole movement kind of transformed those relationships. So, you know, in the end, both Wilbur Slocus and Johnny Jackson ended up being on the, you know, representatives, I forget the name of their role of Columbia River and the Tribal Fish Commission, and I think the leadership ended up sort of changing, the community's relationship to the tribes changed a lot. Yeah, it was really remarkable from both the, in Indian country itself, things sort of relationships changed as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see that the Columbia River Defense Project did publish a book in 1987 called In Defense of Chewana, Fishing Rights on the Columbia River, which I would love to get a copy of that too, to read more about that history.
I could make lots of copies of it. I still got a couple.
Oh, you did, really?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
it's more like a pamphlet almost, but it's a large pamphlet. Yeah,
I really think that you need to do a podcast series on that history because it's really valuable and yeah, I think it's really necessary to know that history. And the you know, the fishing and the, you know, forest policy changes, the fight for the trees, as well as the fish, have been, you know, really important. How much more important do you think they are now? I mean, we've known that climate change was happening our entire lives, really, but I think when I was a kid, they called it greenhouse warming or something.
The greenhouse effect.
Yes, that was it, yes. So how much more important do you think it is today?
Well, how much more important is our removal of the dams? let's just cut to the chase here. I mean, mm-hmm. which is a difficult question because, you know, the dams are a renewable, you know, in some senses a renewable energy in the sense of if their impact on the salmons and the other fish, they're not renewable. But in terms compared to fossil fuel, so that's a difficult question. But yeah, it's so much more important because the fish runs, you know, we're so impacted by pollution and the dams and logging, you know, the impact of the water quality and water quantity and water temperature, the impacts of all those things were very severe and continue to be severe. So the fishery is under much greater threat with a global heat, superheating, planetary overheating, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, keeping the water temperature, you know, we've had large fish kills because, you know, you have these heat domes. They're incredibly dangerous. We have, you know, we don't even understand very well the impact of those relatively, for now, relatively short-lived, really high spikes in temperatures because they're unprecedented. So we're only understanding the impact they have on ecosystems now. I mean, where it's a experiment, we've terrible experiment we've created. So yeah, it's just much more important. So yeah, it's great that there's a movement. I think that the movement came out of both, you know, the native rights and, you know, let's just give credit where credit's due. Earth First was like really one of the first groups that actually, you know, the first action of Earth First was at the Glen Canyon Dam with Ed Abbey and cohort unrolling this long plastic roll of a fake crack down the dam. You know, that was like one of the first real visible public actions talking about the role of dams on our rivers, formerly free-flowing rivers, and the takedown removal movement, I think, would not have happened without Earth First. I mean, let's just, as I said, give credit where credit's due, and just the whole burgeoning direct action environmental movement, which was revivified, you know, kind of started by Greenpeace and the strip mining movement of 50s and 60s. I think we have to, the stakes are so much higher now. And, I don't know. I have a bad feeling myself, but we'll see.
Yeah. I see that Earth First had their 40th anniversary a couple of years ago in 2021. So they've been working at this for a long time and certainly their stance allowed other more moderate groups like to maintain that position and they're sort of the advanced group, you know, pushing forward and in a collaborative way, you know. Mm-hmm. I was wondering as well, and I know we're almost down to the last 8 minutes or so, but I was wondering, how did working directly with Native people, both on the Columbia River and in Black Mesa, how did that impact your perspective on the land, on being an American? How did it change that?
Oh, gosh. You got another 2 hours. I mean, I don't know. I have this little thing, you know, this little thing I tell myself, I tell some people sometimes, that, you know, people talk about decolonization. I mean, I really felt... I felt like I got so deep into it. I mean, I was so fortunate. And again, I feel like I kind of threw it all away in some ways, but I was so fortunate to be taken to, you know, like really special places, you know, like my friend Susanna. Thank you, Susanna, for all you did for all of us and for me. And, you know, her family had a fishing platform on the at Tlachni Falls. I'm butchering the indigenous word for Shearer's Falls there on the Deschutes. And I got privileged to be able to go there to experience that directly with the spray of the falls coming on me and watching her bring up salmon. I don't know if I should say that because I don't think I was supposed to be on that platform. But anyway, so... And then, you know, taken to, you know, through our struggle, I found out about it. We tried to protect Enola Hill. Of course, I just found that the private inholding was logged during the pandemic, which is something I just found out about. Enola Hill is a sacred place there, just right off of Highway 26 near Rhododendron. You know, we found out that that was a traditional Vision Quest site, which we weren't supposed to talk about. Because, you know, we didn't want a bunch of like New Age tourists and stuff, whatever. But, you know, and as a traditional use area, I just got to find out about these traditional use areas, you know, sacred sites. Yeah, it's a whole other map in some ways, if you want to use a sort of that kind of metaphor. I got to a whole other map of the territory. It was with people actually, you know, the whole movement for indigenous place names was tied into that. Renaming things that were named like Devil's Falls or Devil's Ridge and, you know, trying to bring back the names. So those names still stick, unfortunately. But yeah, I got a whole different, you know, and I said, talked about decolonization. I really felt sometimes like I was in a colonized territory. I got, you know, through Native eyes, you know, through my friends and my comrades, I got to view the landscape as colonized territory. I mean, and not in a very concrete way. And that was amazing. I mean, it's a difficult thing because it's difficult to find yourself on the side of the colonized and to really take it seriously and to really struggle with them. That's like, yeah. So yeah, I think that I guess that's in a nutshell.
To find yourself, how did you deal with that? Being a colonizer? I mean, how did you address that?
Well, I just did the work. I mean, and I basically just tried to live my life in as coherent a way as possible and to just see my life as struggle, basically. And again, I'll have to repeat this ad infinitum, my public apology that I didn't fully take it to heart as I perhaps thought I did. Otherwise, I would have stayed and continued to fight. But here I am. I came back. We're here. We're all here. Some of us aren't. Susanna isn't. Johnny Jackson isn't. David So Happy isn't. A lot of my Earth First comrades aren't. A lot of people, you know, struggle is hard. So I guess I don't want to, you know, it's a great thing to be involved with, but you have to, you know, there are sacrifices that have to be made.
Wow. What do you mean by sacrifices?
Well, I mean, it's psychologically, it's I think emotionally it's hard. I mean, you know, I it's defeat, you know, is the idea. That's why people want to be with the winner. I think that, you know, fundamentally, I think that's one reason why people don't, you know, get down with indigenous and African-American causes, because, you know, they came out on the short side of history. And so, you know, people want to be with the winner. If you can't beat them, join them. Anyway, I think deep psychological level, I think there's a lot to that. It's hard to be in the position of fighting for, you know, what seemed like lost cause. You have to take a long view. And you also, you know, you just have to appreciate, you know, I came to really appreciate like Native humor. This the point of view. Just the people themselves just were then, because it was so much more present to me then. But just I don't know. I don't want to be prejudiced, but I just found Native people, or you know, the marginalized community that I happen to find myself associated with, I just found I'm in much more real. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Just much more real because they've really been experienced. Anyway, yeah.
That's really fascinating. Yeah, I think, it's, you don't want to generalize people or anything like that, but certainly our positions relative to structures of power impact how we relate to each other, to the earth, and to our identity. I think, and that may cause the change. I've often said on the show that I see white privilege and white supremacy as sort of, the house that was built by the system of colonization.
And this needs to go a lot further, but I have to step in as host and say we are very much at the end of the hour, Jackie.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This has been really interesting. I hope it's been good for your listeners. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You're listening.